Few people knew that slavery existed on Long Island and that it was the bedrock of Long Island's economy. This is Enslaved Island. I'm Felicia Lalomia.
I'm Brianne Letta.
And I'm Toni Bragna.
So this is a topic that people don't really talk about, especially when it comes to Long Island. What have we been able to find?
Well, a lot of historians I've spoken to have said that over the past few years or so, more and more people are becoming aware that it existed, whereas maybe, I don't know, in the 90s, people might not have known that. But a lot of people don't know how widespread it was, and they don't know that it played such a strong role in their own town's history.
It was such an important part of the economy at the time, and the Long Island that we know now was really built on slave labor. Jonathan Ollie is the curator at the Long Island Museum in Stony Brook. Earlier this year, he was part of a team that put together an exhibition called Long Road to Freedom, Surviving Slavery on Long Island.
It was a chance to look at the African-American experience on Long Island from the colonial period through the 19th century. So essentially we divided the room, which is rectangular in shape, in half. And then basically one half was the slavery story and one half was the freedom story. And so the second half of the exhibition allowed us to tell stories about the development of African-American communities throughout the 19th century, you know, since 1827 through about 1900. And then we had a section at the end called Legacies, sort of looking a little bit about the 20th century experience. So Legacies was the final section of the exhibition. And so in the Legacies of section, we wanted to look at some of the legacies of slavery as they're sort of reverberating in communities of Long Island today. Such as gentrification in traditionally African-American neighborhoods and communities, which formed right at the end of slavery, as well as sort of like the expansion and endurance of African-American communities today as a result of subsequent migration from the American South.
Can you tell us about how slavery impacted and was really related to the economy of Long Island during the period of slavery?
Slavery played a huge role in creating the Long Island that we know today because slave labor was a major part of almost every business in the 17th century and 18th century on Long Island and in New York City.
So you mentioned that slaves were often involved in every business imaginable. So is it believable then that people who said, oh, my hands are clean, I didn't own any slaves, that they still in some way benefited from the institution of slavery?
You often run into this with, you might have some prominent family on Long Island, it's like, oh, my family never enslaved people. Well, that may be true, assuming they've managed to plumb like every lineage of their family and make sure that never happened, which is probably not the case if their family was here in the colonial period. But assuming that's the case, if a Long Island family never actually enslaved anyone, they were still part of the slave labor economy because every middle-class Long Island home had mahogany furniture. It was just one of the status symbols of the period from basically the mid-18th century into the 19th century. Mahogany was cut down in Central and South America in the 18th century and in the early 19th century through slave labor. Like you had enslaved Africans who went into the forests with axes, cut down giant trees, carved them into, you know, more manageable pieces of wood, and then these went on ships that came to either colonial America or the United States, and then they were fashioned into beautiful pieces of furniture, often like right here on Long Island. Particularly like in Southampton or in what became New York City. And those were sold to people. And so that beautiful piece of furniture, which today you can find in like any large museum that has a furniture collection, that any piece of 18th century furniture that they're very proud of, probably was made partially through enslaved labor. And so if you go into any historic home on Long Island, it's now a house museum, you can see this furniture and it's right there, but it's not really on anybody's radar. And another option, or another part of that is sugar. So starting in the 17th century, you had sugar plantations in the Caribbean, and they were incredibly brutal places to work. You had entire islands that were given over to the growing and the manufacture of sugar. And to the extent that even food was not grown there, and food was actually grown up here, including on Long Island, and so food and other supplies would actually be shipped from here down to the Caribbean to be provided for the use of enslaved people and to feed enslaved people. So like you might have, say, like fish that would be caught off of Montauk would go on like a schooner and it would go down to the Caribbean and it would be sold there. The market and the economy of Long Island and the Caribbean and Europe and Africa were all tied together. And that's part of the larger triangular trade that we all learn about in elementary school or high school, hopefully.
So you mentioned Central America with mahogany. Are there any examples of businesses right here on Long Island that people might have purchased from or benefited from, whether they own slaves or not?
Over in Setauket, there was a farmer and he was growing flax, which you used to make linen. Because in the 18th century, like, clothing was made locally generally. I mean, your fancy clothing would come from maybe New York City, or if you have enough money, it would come from Europe. But your day-to-day clothing was made here. And so there was a farmer in Setauket, and he had both free and enslaved laborers, and they grew and harvested and processed flax for him. And so somebody who's wearing a linen shirt that was made locally is wearing something that was made at least partially with enslaved labor. Because nothing is ever sort of wholly made by enslaved labor, because often you, in the same field, you might have the farmer who owns the field, and then you might have a white indentured servant who came over from Europe. You might have two enslaved people who were born here on Long Island, and you might have like one hired day laborer who's like the brother-in-law of the farmer. I mean, and so like all those people can be doing the same exact job in any one context.
So is it fair to say that a typical Long Islander in the 18th century contributed to the institution of slavery, whether they owned enslaved people or not?
Did they help perpetuate? It gets down to a philosophical question. Like, are you helping to perpetuate the problem if you're not doing anything actively to stop it? That's you could argue that today with the, like, a lot of the different issues that we face in society. So I would say that every Long Islander was benefited from the slave economy and benefited from slave labor, whether they actively were enslaving anyone.
Jonathan Ali, curator at the Long Island Museum in Stony Brook. This is Enslaved Island. I'm Tony Brogna.
I'm Brianne Letta.
I'm Felicia Lalomia.
I don't know about you guys, but what he said about mahogany really stuck with me. So he was talking about how mahogany was a big deal on Long Island, but I think it's also really interesting if you think about it. The people who were making the mahogany furniture, the people who were selling it, their whole livelihoods were dependent on slavery. Even though it was slavery that existed in Central America and South America, if they didn't have enslaved workers working in those areas, harvesting the mahogany wood, they wouldn't have a livelihood. They wouldn't have the raw materials that they needed to create the products they were selling.
Yeah, so I think his point was that even if you, as a person, didn't enslave other people, that you still played a part in this industry. It was almost impossible not to do so.
Well, yeah, so anyone who bought, let's say, sugar was participating in a slave economy, because sugar was almost definitely produced by an enslaved person back then.
So oftentimes when we talk about slavery, we don't talk about slavery on the individual level. We're mostly referring to it as this big institution and what it did as this big institution. We don't discuss the individual experiences of the enslaved people. Part of that is because, especially in the North, we don't have stories. We don't have a lot of narratives to tell us what slavery was like in the North. A story that we do have, however, is Venture Smith's. We have his narrative from his perspective from when he was born as a prince in Africa, was captured, and eventually ended up in Connecticut and Long Island. Mark Chambers is a professor of Africana Studies at Stony Brook University, and he worked on an exhibit at the Long Island Museum that incorporated Venture Smith's narrative. Can you just give me a quick synopsis of who Venture Smith was after he went to Barbados and then and ended up in Rhode Island,
I believe. Mm-hmm. Eric Asset, yes.
What did his life look like once he got to Rhode Island and then eventually worked to gain his own freedom and then buy the freedom of his family and then others?
Yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So he arrives in Narragansett. He's a slave of Robert Munford. We know that his name is changed to Venture because Robert Munford actually goes on his venture, if you will, to Africa. Venture Smith tells us that. So he arrives in Narragansett, and then when he arrives in Fisher's Island, he's put to work as a young boy, carding wool and also cutting wood as well. He's considered to be a house slave initially, and then eventually he's sold to a number of other slaveholders in Connecticut, Fisher's Island, back to Connecticut, I believe it is, and then eventually, one event that actually takes place when he's sold, I believe it is his first or second time, that he and an indentured servant, we believe, Hetty, they come up with a scheme, even though Venture Smith says that the scheme is that it's all Hetty's fault that we came up with the scheme. But Hetty approaches him and says, you know, what about escaping? Let's escape. And Venture Smith says to him, I'm paraphrasing, you know, where will we go? And he says, well, let's go out towards the Mississippi River in that direction. So they get a boat, and I believe that maybe two or three other indentured servants or slaves actually join with them. And they get as far as, I believe, into Long Island, maybe around Southampton or East Hampton, and they're captured. And what surprises me about this narrative, I don't know if Venture Smith, for whatever reason, you know, it changed the story, but that Hetty gets punished and Venture just goes back to work. Mm-hmm. And because he blames Hetty, you know, and he tells his master it's all Hetty's fault. So he goes back to work. But then he has some a number of events with a mistress or his owner's mistress. And then the mistress communicates to a husband some bad behavior on Venture's part. So we do know he gets beaten a number of times, and this really surprises him. So I bring that up because, once again, this myth of slavery in the North, and then when people talk about slavery in the North, they say, well, slavery was a kinder, gentler, quote-unquote, type of slavery. But we see that, first of all, if he's trying to escape, then there's something wrong with slavery. So we have to ask the question, if it's a kind of gentle slavery, why would someone want to escape and actually to get their freedom eventually too? So he really gives us, Venture Smith gives us a number of details regarding that too. Mm-hmm. You know, with Venture Smith, you know, trying to escape, he wants his freedom. He understands freedom. Even as a young boy, as a prince, being captured at 6 years old, he understands what freedom means. So I think that we can learn that slavery is slavery. Holding someone against their will is very detrimental to somebody's character, too. Mm-hmm.
So after he purchases his own freedom,
yes,
and he comes to Long Island, what does he do here to earn money to buy his family out of enslavement?
Yeah. When he's on Fisher's Island, he cuts wood in order to earn enough money. That's how he buys his freedom. And then he continues to cut wood in order to buy his children's freedom, but he's also involved in fishing as well. We believe that he finally buys his freedom for around 71 pounds and one shilling. But it takes him, you know, quite a few years in order to finally get that amount of money. And so in today's money, even though it's hard to convert, really he bought his freedom for around $140, which is a very low amount.
I read in his narrative that after he did buy the freedom of his family, he went on to buy other enslaved people as
well. Yes, yeah. And so I believe it's around three other Africans that he does buy. The first person that he buys, I believe it's the first young man that he buys him in order to help him because I believe that he also buys land eventually too to help him establish his homestead. Mm-hmm. He says that he purchases him in order to help him get the homestead up and going, but as soon as he purchased him, he frees him too. So then he purchases two more African slaves. Why? In order to give them their freedom. And so we know that this happens not only in the North amongst within the black community, when you have former slaves that have purchase their own freedom and then purchase their family's freedom, they'll reach out and begin to purchase other slaves in order to give them their freedom as well. And so not only is this happening in the North, but this is happening in the South too.
Talking about his narrative is remarkable. Yes. And we don't have a ton of narratives from the, you know, the people who were actually enslaved as to what slavery was like in the North in general.
Is yeah.
Correct?
Yeah, that's pretty true. In fact, we at the Long Island Museum, when we did the exhibit, so we have Venture Smith, we have Jupiter Hammond, mm-hmm. We also have information from a slave by the name of Conser, or a free black by the name of Conser, Sarah James Smith Garnett. So we have a few stories, but nothing like the stories that we actually had out of the South. But these narratives here are very unique because they are some of the earliest stories that we actually have. Yeah, but not many from the North. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is that because slavery ended a little bit earlier in New York?
That could be it. But then you could ask the question, for those slaves that are still serving, from when they're young children up until around the age of 20 or 22, before they would get their freedom, you know, why don't we have their stories, or why don't we have their narratives? Is it because of the abolitionist movement and it's so strong in the North? You know, I don't know.
So because we don't have a lot of stories from the perspective of the enslaved person, do we know if Venture Smith's story was unique or remarkable, or was it ordinary but just so treasured, I guess, because it's one of very few?
One of a very few. So I would start with, you know, your last comment, one of a very few for the North. But many of the narratives, they follow the same pattern. Olduano Equiano, who's also a slave and captured maybe a decade or two after Venture Smith is captured, follows the same trajectory into the Caribbean, to North America, back to the Caribbean, and then does purchase his freedom. But he ends up free where? In England. But in many of these narratives, they start off with, you know, I was born in Africa. Should it be treasured? Yes, it should be treasured, because it is noteworthy, because it gives credence to slavery here in New York, but also in the North. But does it follow a model that seems to have been laid down very early on in the late 18th century? It seems to follow that same model as Olduano Equiano's mm-hmm. model.
Do you think that because we only have one of very few narratives of the enslavement of people in the North, mm-hmm. that contributes to why people today, specifically on Long Island, either believe slavery wasn't a thing here or believe it was of a gentler kind of slavery?
Yes. Always put that in quotes.
Yeah. I air quoted that.
In the studio, yeah. We're doing air quotes with that. Yeah. I mean, do we need Venture Smith's narrative to really know that slavery existed? The information is out there, you know, that slavery did exist in New York, did exist on Long Island. There's a lot of evidence there. Maybe it's been erased in such a way from our curriculum and we focus so much on the South, and we don't look at what was happening in the Midwest and also in the North too.
Mark Chambers helped to put together an exhibit at the Long Island Museum in Stony Brook on slavery. This is Enslaved Island. I'm Felicia LaLomia.
I'm Toni Brogna.
And I'm Brianne Letta. So, you know what's crazy is that I don't think I ever heard of Venture Smith before we started working on this project. Slavery wasn't, on Long Island specifically, wasn't really incorporated into the curriculum here at all. I went to school here, and I mean, I assumed that it existed, but I don't remember it being a conversation in the classroom.
I totally agree with that. I went to school here as well, and I think we touched on slavery in the South, I think. But now this is the first I'm really hearing of Venture Smith, and it's just like, wow, to see this institution humanized somewhere so close to me, somewhere that I could be almost instantaneously is kind of out of this world.
The Plain Sight Project in East Hampton is kind of trying to undo this narrative of forgotten history about slavery on Long Island. They're trying to prove that not only did slavery exist in East Hampton, but it was prevalent in East Hampton. David Rattray, the editor-in-chief at the East Hampton Star, started this project. He's being helped out by Andrea Meyer, who helps coordinate research at the East Hampton Library. She's the head archivist there of the Long Island Collection.
The Plain Sight Project is an attempt to name and identify every single enslaved person who lived in the town of East Hampton and to try and export that method to other communities so that they too can begin to understand who lived here, what they did, and where they went, what their contributions were to Long Island.
Part of the reason why we're here today is we want to talk a bit about, you know, why the bigger picture of why is it important that we learn about this.
We really are missing an entire portion of our narrative without it. We really don't understand what was actually happening in our culture, in our community, without knowing really how part of the work is being done. I think it's almost impossible to really imagine an accurate picture of the town being built and kind of what daily life was like with missing people in each household all the time. I think it matters that you be able to give people a place in a community. I think it matters to kind of have a complete picture of what's happening in your town and just not to edit people out. History doesn't make much sense if you start removing large portions of the cast of characters. I always refer to a story that was in my history textbook involving Pericles in ancient Greece, and nobody could explain why he was defending Agrippa for criticizing his government. And I said, why is he defending this feminist that's criticizing him? Well, the part that they edited out for the middle school textbook was that she was his mistress. So the story didn't really make any sense when you start removing portions of the history. I think the same is true about any historical narrative, more modern, or you need a full picture.
Yeah, that's really true. It's really clear in East Hampton that what has passed for history up to now has at best been the stories of the big men. And I mean that in the sense economically. And the presence of enslaved people was just eliminated. And the history was really, really told as a series of anecdotes here, not data-driven at all, because had any of the people who were quote-unquote doing history in the 19th century, the 20th century, looked at any of the material that's available, it would have been really obvious that there were enslaved people from the earliest days doing things here and were clearly part of the story. And that's where Plain Sight Project comes from as a name, is there is no mystery. You can open a book of, you know, somebody's account book from the 18th century here and stumble on the name of an enslaved person. They are in plain sight. It's just that no one chose to look, or they were ashamed because of the abolitionist movement or the war between the states or the Civil War. It's hard to put ourselves in the mind of a 19th century or 20th century historian, but there's no question that, you know, the ordinary labor of enslaved men, women, and children was just not told, not passed down.
I think it was also something that people maybe didn't want to acknowledge about the North, did not want to acknowledge about, you know, their own families in many ways. And also, I think there's very much this image of sort of Gone with the Wind slavery, that big plantation and that big farm. And in many ways, the North has destroyed a lot of their historic past, a lot of the big landscape that was here. And I don't think you can really envision the large farms that were all over Long Island for really much of the first 300 years people were here. So I just don't think people see it, because I don't think they're looking to see it, or they want to see it, or, you know, the past is here whether or not you choose to make it present.
I think why this work is important is that without it, you're not telling an accurate story of where America came from. And the argument I make to people is, like, if enslaved people of African heritage worked side by side with the white colonists who built the towns, that built the colonies, that became the states, and, you know, in the Northeast, where really the concept of American democracy began, if you're eliminating people who did half the work. You are eliminating them from the American story. And so any understanding of slavery as at a local level helps correct the record and helps nudge the presence of enslaved people back into the national origin story. And that's hugely important because I think the elimination of those people from the story in some ways can be traced directly to discrimination today, violence against Black men today. I think that we have to understand that as a country, we were not created by a bunch of white Puritans alone. From the earliest days, there were Black people here, and we can prove it. I mean, the documents are in this building.
And how do we get people to pay attention and to care and recognize that the acknowledgement of the history of slavery in Long Island matters?
I think the mechanism to get more people to understand that slavery is inextricable from the life and development, the wealth of the North, is what we're doing. And assembling this database or group of names of individuals. And we're now, we have 250 in East Hampton Town. There's another 160 in Bridgehampton. We've got another 80 in Southampton. We've just really started. We're getting close to 500. I think with a concerted effort in the next couple of months, we can get to 1,000. That becomes hard to ignore. It's easy to ignore the presence of enslaved African people or people of African descent if all you know about are one or two graves here or there on the island. But the minute you have a document or a website that says, here's 1,000 names, I tell you, one way to think about it, if you've ever been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., it's probably the most powerful monument in the city, in a city of monuments. And I see potentially the work we're doing on the Plainsight Project as like that, in sort of a digital form. You know, if you can picture, we print a piece of paper for every single enslaved person we have, and we're already up to 500. That's more than a ream of paper. And you bring it to, say, the county executive's desk, and you go, wham! He's going to notice. And we'll just say, like, well, here it is. What are you going to do with it? And I think that that's how we see our role, is to be platform agnostic, but to do the work, be sound in our scholarship, and be able to say, here are a lot of people, been ignored, not part of the sort of telling of history. What are you going to do about it?
And I think having those specific examples, the more we have of them, particularly the examples of stories, not just so-and-so had an enslaved person, but to have all of these people that focus on the actual people, to focus
really
on their age, their gender, to at least have some sort of picture of who these people were, really does change the narrative. It's building on the same sort of scholarship that's been done for years with social history. It's the same sort of idea that if you have enough little details, you can start to create a better picture of who this person was and what their life was like. And that humanizes them. There's not that many people, I'm always being told, who really get that excited about a bunch of pieces of paper.
Right.
But when it's actual
tell
stories,
them a story.
When it's a person, when they become real, you know, just as it's really hard to ignore a physical building, it makes you more aware of it when there's a physical presence left. Having those stories, they're human again. And a big part of this social injustice and this social histories gap is that these are not people that are normally presented in a very human way.
David Ratray and Andrea Meyer work on the Plainsight Project. This is Enslaved Island. My name is Brianne Letta.
I'm Felicia Lalomia.
I'm Tony Brogna.
We did our best to bring an overview of some of the aspects of slavery in Long Island, but we really only scratched the surface. There is so much more information that I know that I personally wanted to include in the work that we did on this project.
There are so many museums, archives, experts all over the island, and there are so many that I wanted to speak to and didn't have the chance to. So many stories that I want to learn and haven't quite gotten the total grasp of them all yet.
The information is out there, and I think that is important to realize, that although there isn't a ton of documentation on slavery in the North, there's still a lot of documentation on slavery in the North, and all you have to do is go look for it. This podcast was produced by the three of us and
Kiara Thomas
and Priya Shahi.
Thank you for listening.